Tom George is the founder and principal of GoMo Consulting, a management consulting firm specializing in sales enablement. In this interview, Tom shares his experience as a sales enablement leader and consultant. He discusses how his background in product marketing helped him have a successful career in sales enablement, which he describes as the strategy to execution arc. Tom also talks about the future of sales enablement and how it should be a strategic priority within a business rather than the last stop. Then he shares some really important strategies on landing big clients like VMware, PayPal, and Microsoft. He even goes into detail on a project that he did with Microsoft that involves 36,000 salespeople. Tom also shares important lessons he learned from his time on these projects, including how to measure sales enablement and what those KPIs should be. The interview includes a lively discussion on AI and sales enablement, which segues to an interesting debate on whether or not AI will replace jobs in sales. If you're interested in sales enablement or sales enablement consulting, this interview is definitely worth a listen. So Tom, you have a different sort of background that I don't often see with sales enablement leaders. You have a tremendous background. You've been consulting for on and off for 15 years. But particularly what I wanted to hone in on right now is, you know, you were in product marketing early in your career, and then you transitioned into sales enablement. Often what we see is sales training evolving into a sales enablement career. I think that's the common pathway. Yep. But the funny thing is, we always talk about the relationship between sales enablement and product marketing.
Right.
So it's funny that you came from that background. Can you talk about, you know, how that kind of played in and how you think that's advantageous to where you are now?
Yeah, definitely. I sometimes say that sales enablement is the yang to the product marketing yin. Early in my career, I got an MBA and I worked for enterprise software and one SaaS company. This is in the mid-90s to mid-2000s. And those were in strategy roles, product management, product marketing. And then fast forward to, 7 or 8 years ago, I really honed in on sales enablement and focused in on execution, sales execution, and in particular, sales enablement, including leading sales enablement for two companies.
Right.
And that was, I call it the strategy to execution arc. But in between, I had about 15 years of consulting, working for very large technology companies in go-to-market projects.
Right.
And, the advantage there is in many cases where I worked, they were really good at go-to-market. And so I really sort of saw how it should work. As a strategist, I would get frustrated that I would create playbooks and decks and content and training and roll it out to sales. And lo and behold, nothing would happen. They didn't drop everything. The sales team didn't drop everything to pick up the new strategy. And then fast forward to sales enablement, I had an experience that I think a lot of sales managers and sales enablers and salespeople have in that, what was coming out of the go-to-market teams wasn't very cohesive. The programs weren't holistic. The lead quality was low. And so that frustration of seeing the misalignment and seeing what was landing was just not of particularly high quality. So, I used to say that I'm trying to create a bridge between marketing and sales. I think that's the wrong way to put it. It really is more nuanced than that. It's really about getting go-to-market functions and teams creating an engine. It's getting product marketing and content marketing and growth marketing and sales operations and sales enablement working together to focus on how sales is pursuing a market and winning in a segment. And so creating that orientation and that cohesion across all those teams, that's really what I think is the key, what I've seen work very effectively in some cases, and what I've tried to build in the smaller companies where I've worked in-house.
Well, the reason I ask the question is I've never been a product marketing person. So I've had to work with them, obviously, quite a bit. But what I think about is messaging and getting it really, really accurate based on what we understand about the buyer specifically.
Right. Yes.
So that's the link that I'm trying to understand is, when you come in from a sales training background, commonly you've carried a bag, you've carried a quota, and either wanted to go to management or you did, or you know, so there was that leadership calling.
Right.
You know, coming from a product marketing standpoint, I would imagine it is a little bit more scientific than that pathway. So I'm wondering, is it advantageous? Is it, you know, a better, do you make a better sales enabler coming from a product marketing background? Is that fair to ask?
Certainly. And I think it highly depends, but I believe that sales enablement is in a great position to really serve in a strategic role that, you know, the tactical functions of onboarding, training, implementing methodologies, right, coaching, competencies.
And that stuff's not native to product marketing necessarily. That's
not at all.
More native to a sales training background.
Yeah, so
that's what I'm trying to get to. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I had to learn in these sales enablement roles. I'd been around sales enablement a long time, but I hadn't actually owned the function and done all those things. Right. So it was in the, you know, the last 5 years or so that I've really sort of focused in on that and owned
the execution piece, like you refer to it as
exactly
that layer.
Yeah.
You mastered early on the strategy layer in the product marketing side of things, which not a lot of us are exposed to coming up from the front line. Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of the reverse of anything.
And
you having that background, I'm sure, is what led to some of these amazing projects that you got into with big companies and big projects.
Right, so, right.
I think we're going to talk about a little bit of that. But
Well, I mean, to answer your question, you know, I don't, there's, you know, lots of different sources of good enablers, and it's, you know, product marketing can be one. I think it helps to understand the messaging, to understand, you know, what is the definition of the market? Who are the personas? You know, what is our value proposition and differentiation? That all helps. I also happen to think that sales enablement is in a great position to see what's working in market. You know, they have a lot of exposure to deals and to salespeople. And so they can collect information about what's working and what isn't and relay that back to product marketing to get into, you know, the strategy. And then have that permeate through. So, so in that sense, having that sort of background helped me relate to product marketing and provide that sort of input, to that team or those leaders. But you know, it's also, I think, sometimes sales has a very high expectation about product marketing. And I think what's important to realize is that product marketing is the source of a lot of strategic important information, but it's the source for other teams to enact, starting with product management to build a good product, but also growth marketing, you know, working with the demand gen team to target very effectively, working with content marketing to produce the content that's really going to move a buyer.
Resonate. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then sales enablement, you know, have a close relationship there so that what product marketing is producing, which is, you know, let's face it, it's probably a little more academic. It's typically in a big, long deck, right? You know, it's enablement's job.
We need bite size.
That's exactly right. It's an enablement's job to break that down into components that can be used or that will convey the knowledge in training. And you know, more and more, that's about doing that in bite-sized chunks. So, so yeah, it definitely helps to have that kind of strategy orientation. The other thing that I would say is that where I think where sales enablement can go is to play more of a strategic role in terms of managing the flow of projects and campaigns and go-to-market initiatives. You know, enablement is sort of the last stop in the go-to-market effort, and really everything should go through enablement, in my opinion. And, that puts enablement in the position of being a regulator. A regulator, both in terms of volume, like, you know, you have to protect sales time, but also in terms of timing. You know, a lot of departments are trying to create programs and projects that need to land on sales, and they're not thinking about the third month of a quarter or November and December. Hey, let's do the launch. The, you know, the product's going to be ready.
It's like, they don't know the audience.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not integrated the way that sales enablement is or should be.
Exactly.
So at different levels of an organization, you're going to see this, right? At a smaller organization, that responsibility, I think, is carved in a lot of times to sales operations, right?
Yes.
Or revenue operations, depending on what the strategy is, right? And as we move up market into large organizations, you start seeing the specialist roles kind of, you know, being divided, and sales enablement splits off and has a more strategic focus, like what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I can't agree more. That running everything through enablement so that it lands and it actually gets adopted.
Right.
You know, the strategic partnership, truly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
And the funny, I'm glad you said that, because there are projects. I was digging into your background, and I know we had our conversation offline, but I was digging through your profile as well. So some of the projects you ran earlier in your career as a sales enablement consultant were centered around some of the things you just talked about. So just for those that are listening and watching, on one hand, you're going to get a lot of sales enablement insight, strategy to execution. And another side, you're also going to get the consulting journey, because as I mentioned earlier, Tom has been consulting on and off for 15 years, all in the go-to-market operations and sales enablement arena.
Yeah.
And let me add this. He's done consulting projects with companies like Microsoft, VMware, PayPal, Avaya, Cisco, and has some great stories he can actually share with us about some of these journeys as well. So, but before we get into that, on the consulting journey path, one thing that we're always wondering is, how do we get clients?
Oh, yeah.
So before we zoom in to the client work,
let's
stay at 40,000 feet. How did you get clients like Microsoft, VMware, PayPal as an independent consultant? Was it through, like, tell me your strategy of like getting clients in those days early
on? Yeah. Well, so as a little, just to provide some context and some timing, I mentioned earlier, I had worked for enterprise software and SaaS companies, did a couple startups that were acquired. That got me to 2006. In those roles, it was product marketing and managing marketing, which, by the way, is also at the second startup. It's the first time I managed a sales function, because it was sales development. So that was quite a learning curve. Mm-hmm. It got me out of the ivory tower of strategy definition and into, you do have to execute this. So that was quite a learning curve. And this got me to 2006. And at this point, I was kind of wondering, like, okay, well, what am I going to do next? It was kind of an interesting time after the dot-com bubble had burst. I was offered or asked by a friend to do a consulting project. This was the VP of corporate marketing at Plantronics. He needed help planning and coordinating with his two business units. So that was my first project. So it was through a friend, through my network.
The network. Yep.
Yep.
Exactly.
Did he
know that you were open to consulting? Had you socialized? We're from my network as well, like I think a lot of us, but how that emerges is always interesting. Is that just, I'm in the market to do consulting, or he just, serendipitously knew to hit you up?
Yeah. Well, I have to give him credit, because he was a personal friend, and I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do now? And he said, hey, look, I need somebody who can manage these general managers and work with me to, create a plan and provide some oversight to that. But I can't afford to hire somebody full time. So can you do this on a contractual basis? Yes, of course.
There we are.
Same sort of thing happened with the next project, which was at Microsoft. And so in 2007, I got my first project at Microsoft. I ended up working there 3 years doing three projects. So these were big projects. But to answer your question, that was through a connection, another personal friend that I had who was also doing consulting contracting work for Microsoft.
Interesting.
It's a double tap.
It's not just the network, but it's also those partnerships with, other advisors, consultants that are talking to the same customer.
Exactly. Now, here's sort of on the consulting journey, two things to consider. At Microsoft, they don't hire individuals to come in and write. So I was directed to work with a staffing company that provided staffing to Microsoft. And they use a lot of flexible staffing, temporary workers. So I got connected with this staffing company, and that's how I got the second and third project at Microsoft. It was not through a personal connection. It was through the...
So were these second and third projects in other areas of Microsoft? I mean, it's massive.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how the jump happened.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's how I got connected to a couple other staffing companies. At least one case, I reached out at some point. And, you know, so my job at Avaya, my job at Cisco came through a staffing agency. It was a small company in San Francisco called M Squared that got acquired by Solomon Edwards. So that's one thing to consider about how I found work. It started through my network, but then for these bigger companies, they use staffing agencies. The other thing that was happening is, you know, consider the timing. I was at Microsoft when the financial crash happened and the recession started.
2008.
Yeah. And until 2010, I worked there. So, you know, thank you, Microsoft, helped out.
Some shelter during and some stormy weather.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, the other thing that happened is these projects that were coming to me were pretty big strategic projects.
Let's drill into those because the one thing that obviously I want to talk about Microsoft and Cisco. I think you said 36,000 salespeople.
Yeah,
was the scope of one project.
Yeah,
can you talk about that one with Microsoft real quick? Yeah,
yeah. So you're exactly right that I moved from one group to another, one division within Microsoft to another. The second project that I did was in digital advertising. They had acquired a company that had six, it was actually an aggregation of six companies. So they had six different sales teams. So the project was to really sort of bring all those sales teams onto one instance of Dynamics CRM. I did a Dynamics implementation very similar to Salesforce, right. But also got them on the standard Microsoft sales process and then stood up sales operations, the pipeline reporting and the cadence with management. That then led to a project at the Enterprise Products Group, which was what it was called at the time. It's no longer called that. That group, the year before I arrived, and this was in 2010, they did $26 billion in revenue, right? This was the big group in Microsoft. They had 36,000 salespeople, as you detected. I was hired by a senior director in sales operations. Sales operations itself had 2,700 employees globally.
Good Lord. Yeah. Still very unbalanced.
Yeah, still. Yeah, indeed. Now, what was very interesting about that project, it was a six-month project, and you mentioned earlier about how sales ops kind of owns, you know, the initial coordination of go-to-market efforts. The thing about Microsoft is that they have a very regimented, rigid, proven, established process for monthly business reviews and quarterly business reviews and territory planning and the financials of managing a pipeline and sales.
Those structures, yeah.
Yeah. What was happening at the time, though, was there was this other set of work, which was all the projects and programs for go-to-market. And in particular, this was at a time when they were just rolling out Azure. And in particular, in sales operations, they were introducing two new roles that were specific for Azure into their sales team. And they had 35 or roles in sales already, and they were introducing two more. They had an amazing coverage model. And there were just a lot of projects and activities that were happening, and they felt like they needed more control and visibility into the projects and programs that all these different groups, constituent groups, were running that needed to land on one or more teams in the sales organization. And so I was hired to establish a project management office, a PMO, in sales operations to get their arms around what are all the programs.
Right.
It wasn't called enablement.
This thing has tentacles. It's an octopus. And
really, just create visibility.
Right.
Fantastic project. Some lessons that I learned is that it wasn't this super sophisticated information set that I was creating. It was actually just a simple status report in a standard template, one page in a PowerPoint slide. and then a couple of views on the catalog of projects, including a calendar view showing what projects, programs, enablement activities, et cetera, were being rolled out,
right,
and what sales teams were to be impacted. And then to facilitate a monthly meeting with all the stakeholders to go through that and create coordination. So, you know, the first lesson was, it wasn't like a deep analysis kind of thing. Simple information, but standardized, comprehensive. That was the key thing. The second thing is, you know, the precious commodity was sales time. Right. And there are very rigid rules. I know Salesforce is like this too. Very rigid rules on how much time sales can be taken away from sales, right? They need to be focused on selling.
Like the brick wall. You know,
the brick wall, right.
Yeah, we need to keep the brick, you know, keep the wall up and make sure they're not distracted.
Exactly. So that was the precious commodity. Everybody knew it. There were all kinds of projects and programs. What was great about it is that the team there, and this is executive teams. So, you know, in this monthly meeting that we had VPs of professional services, you know, 12,000 employees reporting to that person, or the public sector team, or, the solutions consultants, that type of thing. Those right. folks represented by executives. And they were willing to work together, right? They were willing to like have conversations and compromise and push projects out or elongate projects so they were willing to work together. That was so refreshing to see, especially at that size. You know, you'd think it could be.
Well, was that institutionalized
yeah.
stuff
yeah.
and cultural stuff? Or
was that a culture.
Like yeah. individuals that surprisingly at their level were that amenable and, you know.
I think both. Yeah, I think both. I mean, I didn't see how it got established. I just right. saw it in action, and it was just fantastic to see.
Right.
I think the third thing that I would say, and this is, you know, part of the services that I now provide and want to focus on is they were really good at then planning, right? And identifying dependencies. This is something that I see in go-to-market a lot, is that executives agree on the strategic initiatives, and then they go off and they plan their projects. And while there's agreement at a high level, the timing, the dependencies across teams and getting the inputs.
Well, it goes back to the PMO office, that project management.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So, you know, I think for a lot of sellers, in a lot of cases, these projects sort of land flat, and it's right. because they're not delivered holistically. They're not timed well, they're not coordinated. And so having that sort of discipline to dot the I's and cross the T's on really delivering a whole package of the goods and doing it well and following up and all that stuff, that's
the execution layer.
That's the execution piece. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 The issue is often for me, it's not the strategy. I mean, if you got a bad strategy, that's not good, but you know, if you've got a reasonable strategy, it's about execution. And then you can refine the strategy. Again, if you've got the good feedback coming back, you can refine the strategy to make it better.
We'll talk about execution in terms of KPIs. So
yeah,
you've been doing this at scale. You've seen what it looks like,
right?
What good looks like at scale.
Yeah.
So organizations that are midway, trying to get there, you know, mid-market, even starting out,
right,
trying to learn from these best practices wherever possible. You know, the little guys are trying to compete like the big guys. That's sweet.
Right.
We know that. So having someone like yourself who's been there, done that, come in, that's kind of the value proposition I imagine you offer.
Yeah.
But talk about the KPIs. Like, what are the measurables and the outcomes yep. that we, if we're getting serious about sales enablement and PMO,
yep.
what are those measurables that we should concentrate on?
Well, so, I mean, I could go on a long time about this. And in fact, I have a video, a short version and a 12-minute long version of the sets of metrics for managing sales enablement. You can find on the resources page of my website. But, there are the sort of process metrics, and then there is the effectiveness metrics of how you improve sellers' performance. So the process metrics are you arming the sellers with what they need to sell? And I would also, you know, I would include onboarding for that. I would also include, are you providing the training and content needed to know how to sell? And then there's the sales effectiveness metrics of, you know, are you rating competencies and you know, scoring deals and those types of metrics to improve performance. And then there's the strategic impact metrics, which is, you know, sort of, are you moving the dial?
Is that like the productivity metrics, the call duration or response rates, time to meeting? Is that the,
I mean, I would put those either in the efficiency bucket or the effectiveness bucket. Generally, when I'm talking about impact metrics, I'm saying there's a go-to-market initiative, and it might be something like, you know, deal acceleration, deal velocity. We want to reduce the time it takes on average to close a deal.
Okay,
that's an impact metric in my mind. It's an output, not something that you measure along the way. I would say something like call duration or even conversion rate, you know, that's really more either in efficiency bucket or effectiveness bucket. So efficiency for me is really related around, I mentioned onboarding, and then the training and content usage. Right. So this is,
these are direct measurables. These are things that you can measure from your efforts, whereas everything else that we talked about, direct call duration, lifecycle staging, all of those things are all a tertiary to what you can control.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think the things that you're talking about, because you're a sales manager, right? You know, that those are sales management metrics that add up or sort of fill in,
right?
Again, either the efficiency or the effectiveness. In particular, I'd say the effectiveness with what you're talking about. But yeah, and so this does bring me to my experience at Cisco, where in 2015 and 16, I was hired to be the metrics lead for a newly created sales enablement team. Mm-hmm. This is a team of about 20 people. At the time, Cisco had 23,000 salespeople. They knew they needed scorecards and metrics, but they weren't exactly sure what that meant, to be perfectly honest. And so they right time, right place for me, you know, being with the staffing agency, they needed an enablement metrics lead. And there I was. So I took that role. That was an exercise around the content and training, you know, to get their arms around that and have visibility into usage of that, of the, you know, those materials.
Right.
So we created a data lake of content management information, LMS learning management information. We pulled in the sales hierarchy from the HR system, and then eventually took the step of pulling in CRM data to get to do some pipeline analysis work. And what the big deliverable there, we did several projects, but the big deliverable was building a reporting system in Tableau where we could see there are 11 layers of the hierarchy. So we could see down to an individual seller, and for an individual asset, you know, did they use this asset and all the, you know, training, you know, LMS and CMS type
macro type data. Micro data associated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, it is in some respects, a tactical and maybe even a vanity metric. Like, you know, you hear, oh, hey, we're getting X.
They're signals. They're signals.
Yeah.
Not necessarily exactly. Hard.
Yeah. You know, and that's exactly how we used them. The reporting system was for sales management. It was to say for an individual or a team, and again, we could see it for a country, for a geo, for a region, whatever. You know, are we getting the adoption that we want? And by the way, there were commitments. You know, like we did a product launch, and there was a package of training and a package of content, and the team signed up to hit the adoption metrics or usage metrics. But what we were able to do is then go to sales management, the sales managers of all the teams who were signed up with MBOs or OKRs to do this and say, hey, you know, you're signed up for this. You're not going to hit your MBO, so you need to do something. The other thing that we did then, speaking of signals, this is where we pulled in the CRM data, is to follow up that those usage metrics with. And by the way, here's what we're seeing in the pipeline in terms of revenue around this product launch that we've created. You're on track, that's great, or you're not on track. You know, we did the launch in Q2, where there's an expectation there'd be revenue generated in Q4. We wanted to see the pipeline in Q3. So it was a signal. It was a, you know,
indicators. That's why we call them indicators. They're not, you know,
It's not the end result. But it is a leading indicator. And that's how we used it. The other thing that we did, and I see this in the sales enablement platforms now, is we were packaging up content and training in support of a campaign or the product launch. You know, we had 6 training modules and then a bunch of content. And that was super effective to really start to get 360 degree views on how to enable, right? Mm-hmm. How to enable a campaign or program. Sometimes we would see that we had the content that would help move deals through the sales stages and it wasn't being used. And so, you know, we've got this thing around single sign-on or whatever, you know, like the InfoSec white paper that would help move a product along or a deal along, but it wasn't being used. And so, you know, we'd investigate why is that, and then we'd be able to bump it up. And if we were told, I tried using it, it wasn't effective, then we'd new content. Yeah. Typically it was, I didn't know that existed. Right. And so,
because I have 15,000 other pieces of content that I'm trying to use.
I did the analysis of the content system, and it was shocking how many pieces. I mean, it's a super technical.
That a lot of these tools are doing it now. What is your go-to sales engagement, not sales engagement, but sales enablement platform? Is there a contact management system, a content management system that you prefer? What's the, from a tech side?
I'm not going to say. No. but also, you know, I it's not that I have like a wealth of experience. I've seen and used several. Seismic, Highspot. I haven't gotten my hands on Showpad, but I expect it's, pretty reasonable.
The Seismic sounds like, I mean, I think they're a leader in that space, no doubt.
Yeah. And you know, G2 shows got a good, what do they call that? The matrix, the quadrants and who the leaders are and whatnot.
I think
what's difficult about that representation, just zeroing in on the G2, is that, you know, what Clary does is a hell of a lot different than what Highspot does, and they're grouped in the same category. So it's really, you know, what are you trying to automate or facilitate?
Fair enough.
You have to know what the use case is. For me, the success of the tool, the tool needs to be pretty good, right? But it is just like the strategy, just like the segment strategy. It is or just like implementing a sales methodology, it's really hugely dependent on how well you operationalize it. How well do you?
You can't operationalize without the technology, though. These days, right? Like you.
Yeah.
You're not going to have someone like you were doing packaging things any longer. Now, you know, you need to invest into technology to underpin the strategy.
That's exactly right. Yeah, but in implementing it, it is so much, especially with salespeople, and this is the challenge of the technology, you don't want to introduce a new workflow.
Right.
And this has always been the problem with content management and learning management systems, is like salespeople work in email and LinkedIn and,
their CRM/engagement platform. Yeah.
Right. And to make them go to another place, that's always been the challenge. So I am
seeing tabitis.
Yeah. Exactly. I am seeing a shift where it's less about training and content and becoming more about guidance. And I think, by the way, I think AI is going to play a big role in that.
I was kind of hoping you were going to go there with it, because that's the question that we're asking people, is like the prompts. Right? Yeah. The prompt tools, the AI-based prompt tools that are being developed as we speak. I had an interview recently with a company that's in R&D, and they were asking my viewpoint on what do salespeople need? What do SDRs need at the point of impact.
Yeah.
They have an AI-based tool. They wouldn't tell me a whole lot about it, but it was an AI-based tool that is going to provide real-time enablement. And I think most of the focus, if not all of it up until this point, has been on that enabling the individual, getting the person, you know, the knowledge, the skills that they need to be ready for that moment of impact. But the problem with that model is that, you know, like the context is ever changing.
I mean, yes.
One prospect, the same prospect from one day to the next, one week to the next, versus different accounts and industries, and this, all these layers to the context always evolving. Having just-in-time content that's AI, it can hear the call, see the email, and tell you what's the best and most effective based on some of the things you had talked about, like efficacy that they've seen in other stages or whatnot. So, I would imagine that tech, where Seismic and whoever is your favorite, I mean, you can put Gong in that category, right?
So, sure. Yeah. So in 2019, when I said, you know, I joined a SaaS company, the first SaaS company that I joined was a sales tech AI company called Tribal. I joined at the seed stage. I was employee number 9. And actually my role was not to enable our sales team. It was to implement our technology and enable our clients' sales team.
Oh, and I love this part of the discussion, because I actually had that queued up in, I was looking at your profile and I had that question lined up. Like how do you enable customers as opposed to all these salespeople? So yes, go on. Thank you for going there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this really drove home the need to make this efficient and effective and in the workflows of the salespeople. So this system, I won't go into too much detail, but the whole idea was to create a messaging framework to feed a machine learning engine so that you could pull out the incidences of messages in call conversations, in documents, on websites, et cetera, et cetera. The whole idea is then integrate with CRM data and you can see what messages are most prevalent in wins, what messages are prevalent or not prevalent in losses. And then you know, the machine would then say, oh, you're talking to a new account and a persona in that account. Here's a message that you should bring up. And this was typical sort of med pick messaging, right? Yep. Campaigns, KPIs, use cases, value propositions, this sort of thing. And we tried different ways of presenting this. We had our own UI. We created a Chrome extension. So, you know, you could use it very simply in that way.
Right.
We just didn't get adoption to be
a little early for your time, maybe, though, right? I mean,
what's that?
Maybe a little early.
Possibly. I think we'll see. Right. I mean, we'll see.
But this, that's still a valid use case today, is the point. Is that sounds like next level enablement to me.
Right. Well, and I would also say that, you know, there's this enormous lift of creating this messaging framework, which was actually my job, was to like write all the messages in this framework and then have it feed the machine, as we called it. And then
literally,
present messages.
Literally, yeah.
And I, you know, there was, I think, a UX issue. There was concerns about, is this really a valid message? We had to get to a critical mass, but we didn't get to that in one or two of our implementations. And so the reps were like, I'm seeing the same message over and over. Like, what's the point at this point? So, you know, there were just some practical challenges. I think if you know, what I'm starting to see is AI that presents content and training that will help, not messaging. So, you know, it's tied to the enablement platforms we were talking about earlier of presenting, oh, here's the document you should use at this point in the sale. That's probably more effective. But again, you don't want to take a seller out of where they live and work. And by the way, they don't want to live and work in CRM. so that really is a challenge.
Sometimes they have no choice.
Yeah.
And we don't want to perpetuate the idea of them not working inside their CRM.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's going to have an impact, AI, you know, broadly. I think it is going to be around guiding sellers.
Right.
I know that there's this ongoing debate about are we going to lose sales jobs? I don't think that's the case.
Well, I disagree 100%.
You think we're going to lose it?
Yeah. I mean, it's at the essence of more with less. You could have less SDRs doing the same amount of high quality work.
Yeah. So I'm going to give a plug to Steve Silver at Forrester. He did an analysis and made a proclamation a year or two ago that we're going to lose a million sales jobs.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. I don't know how many we're going to lose, but I would imagine, yes.
Yeah. Well,
we already have, I've had interviews on here where people have talked about having smaller teams.
Yeah.
Doing as good or better.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's true. I think you could say the same thing about the customer engagement platforms. What ended up happening is everybody's got the customer engagement platform. You know, there's an expansion of the capability, but there's still a hell of a lot of SDRs, you know, required and salespeople required. I consider it to be, you know, in terms of, is it going to take over and do a sales job? This is Steve Silver's point.
Well, I mean, full functioning. I mean, of course not. I don't think you can have, we're not there yet, correct. Where they're having two-way conversations with, you know, people like this.
Well, Steve Silver, the guy at Forrester, his point is, you know, he was looking at it from the standpoint of the digital buying experience and what are the buyers' experience, and they do a lot themselves, and AI can facilitate that significantly.
Right.
But what it did is it didn't decrease the number of human touches. It actually just increased the number of total touches. So buyers were engaging a lot more, but some of it was in a digital way. His point was there was still a need to engage a buyer. There was still a desire. I consider it like pilots in a plane. Planes can fly themselves right now. But are you going to get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? No. Right? That was the Supermax experience.
We're getting in cars that don't have drivers. We're right there.
Yeah.
We're not far away.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, will always be the need for the human contact.
Well, I don't think that's the debate. I don't think it's about whether we will binarily have salespeople or not. The question is, will jobs be affected? And I think it's a unanimous that it's inevitable that it's an impact jobs from like being able to turn people into cyborgs effectively, where they're able to do a lot more with less. And then, I think that will, because the productivity will be able to be maintained at a certain level, that you will be able to see a percentage of maybe not salespeople, like account executives, maybe that's maybe not the role that will be most impacted now.
Yep.
But I would imagine earlier stage roles like an SDR role, or those size of teams are being reevaluated based on what some of this tech is going to be able to do, I would imagine. And the companies that are living and breathing this technology, you take the companies that have developed and have AI into their go-to-market motion and their product. You take a LeadIQ, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. They have their Scribe tool, for instance.
Right.
So I think these are case studies that we can look at and say, they are doing, you know, they have smaller teams than they did once before, and they're still producing as much, if not more, pipeline.
Yeah. I think you nail it right in referring to it as a productivity tool. It's going to improve the productivity. But you know, on the flip side, I also think AI is going to create a bunch of jobs, right?
True.
And so new companies and more stuff to sell.
Exactly.
So, as the world turns,
we could talk AI all day, I'm sure. I probably hit my limit, to be honest. I want to zoom out the time that we have left and go back to the journey of being a sales enablement consultant. So, you came out of Cisco. You shared the story with me how you came out of Cisco's that project, and you didn't have a funnel. And consultants everywhere can relate to this, where we're heads down doing client work. We don't have a lot of opportunity. Look, even us sales consultants, we don't prospect as much as we tell you to prospect. It's just
real. Right.
And most of us build our models and our businesses so that it's inbound. You know, Scott Lees talks about how he's never cold called in a day. He's always, all his clients have come to him. So that's cool. But did you learn a valuable lesson about prospecting during that time before? Because I know you're starting a new venture now with GoMo Consulting.
Yes.
But did you learn a valuable lesson about always be prospecting, or how did that lesson of coming out of Cisco and being jazzed, but then not having any clients lined up, how did that affect you now?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So, as context, post-recession, I felt like there were a lot of jobs that were available. We got to 2016. I had big projects essentially coming to me, not entirely, but, to a large degree. And then 2016, I come out of Cisco and the next big project wasn't there. It was like, now what do I do? And that's when I started Enablio, the company you referred to earlier. I thought, okay, I know enablement. I didn't really know enablement. What's the problem? What I did was to align myself with some vendors to get projects that way. So I partnered with Outreach and with a competitor of theirs called Frontspin. Mm-hmm. And I did implementations of those tools into small to medium businesses. And that kept me going for almost 3 years, but it's not the work that I wanted to do. And I really wanted to get into sales enablement to learn that. So I shifted mm-hmm. over. What I'm doing, so there were two things about that experience in 2016 with Enablio. The first is I didn't really have an offering, right? I wanted to do enablement. I was really like, okay, I'm a pretty smart guy. I know how to do project management. Hire me, right? Well, nobody does. Nobody's going to hire that.
The product marketing guy skipped product marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
I had to throw that in there.
That's exactly right. Have some offerings and be very concrete. And if you go to the GOMO site, you'll see that mm-hmm. I'm much more concrete. And in fact, what I'm finding is while I want to do strategic consulting or advisory or, that sort of thing, the way I'm getting in now is with tactical projects, right? So sales tech optimization or, buyer journey mapping and that sort of thing. But then leverage that into more strategic work.
More engagements. That's like you mentioned before, you had the agency that was getting you into those second and third projects at Microsoft, but now that you don't have that, it's you get that land and then you expand with your
that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I am looking for veins or channels that I can tap, and I've been fortunate in early going through my network to find some project work, but that's not going to build. I don't want to do this for just me, right? Like, so I want to build a consulting company.
There was two lessons that came out of Enablio. There was the marketing lesson, and I want to make sure I didn't miss the second one. What was the other lesson that came out of?
Well, and that is to truly prospect. I mean, in some respects, you could say that I did the right thing at that time because I associated myself with some product companies,
right?
And
right.
I, they were referring work to me, and that's how I was able to make some money. That is a channel that I'm
doing today,
pursuing now through my contacts with sales tech vendors. I'm looking to see if I can leverage that.
So there's a three-pronged approach that you have now. You shared with me offline that you're leveraging. Let's go through it in order. I think you mentioned the tech partnerships.
Yeah. There will still always be my network, and
number one.
Yeah. And, the thing about my network is like, I've got 2,500 LinkedIn contacts. That's not my network, right? In terms of where I'm going to find.
And neither is your 15,000 people that you're connected with on LinkedIn, whoever's listening.
Right.
Like, let's hone this down to who really is the network that can help you get into opportunities.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And so these are the cherished relationships that I've got of former employers or bosses, or people I've known who are now in a buying position.
And they're familiar with your work, which is
the important
point to make there is it's not someone who's inferred your knowledge through social media content, but have seen your work, have worked with you.
Yeah.
And that's the advantage of having sort of been around and having the tracker that you have.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another place that I'm going is that I have some connections at some VC firms. And what's interesting about what's happening with VC firms is, and I think private equity firms also, is that they have operational teams. And and the issue is
they have go-to-market experts within their their portfolio for their portfolio companies.
Yeah, exactly. Now they provide really a dual function. One is the advisory services, but the other is they're keeping tabs on what's happening in the company for the, you know, for the partners of the VC to say, hey, you know, like, let me give you some perspective on this. So the issue for them is that they're an inch deep and a mile wide. They, you know, they're providing advisory services to many companies. They see challenges. They don't have the capacity to do anything about it other than to provide advisory services.
Yeah, actually roll their sleeves up and get into the,
So there's actually, I think, a good opportunity, and I'm getting some feedback on this that, yeah, you know, it would be great to be able to say, hey, you have a challenge in this area and here's somebody you should talk to. So that's another, you know, vein. Like, I'm trying to find these veins that I can mine.
Insert your needle.
Right. Yeah. Well, different vein, but yeah, same. I get it.
I think about IV.
But you know, another one is
we have the network, we have product partners, and part of the network was the VC realm, right?
Correct. That is correct. And then
I love your spin on cold calling or cold out.
Yeah. Yeah. So then I am like, I got to eat my own sales dog food. And so I am picking target segments to go after, and, you know, doing cold outreach. And I've got, you know, I've got my data sources of leads. I've got my sequencing tool, and I am.
And which one, what are you using? What's your sequence tool?
I actually have went with Apollo because they have the converged solution of both the data and the sequencing.
It's funny because Donald C. Kelly from the Sales Evangelist, he actually went down into the weeds on his team's workflow using Apollo.io. So there's a plug for Apollo. Cool.
Yeah. Now, you know, my background is SaaS, so I know that market and technology generally. So, I know it really well. We're experiencing headwinds in that industry, some big headwinds. But if you consider my experience with the recession in, you know, 2009 and the years following, that might be a great time to go after SaaS because, you know, they don't have the resources that they used to have. They still have a lot of work to do. And a flexible model, staffing model might be really good because, hey, it's a variable cost, not a fixed labor cost, right? So so there may be a play there. I'm sort of, that's one thing I'm testing. And then I'm testing segments where I think enablement could play, where it's not as prevalent. So sales enablement, you know, really sort of rose out of SaaS and technology. You know, I've seen in my career the shift from product-led sales to value selling. It's happened in software and in technology. I think it's happening in other places. You know, manufacturing, as an example. I've seen some case studies there. And so, you know, find some segments within that and see, you know, it's a different model because they sell through a channel. So it's as much about channel enablement as it is sales enablement.
Well, I mean, it was the same in tech as well with our hardware vendors that were
selling
through
Cisco and Avaya.
Definitely
Plantronics. So
just transfer that same or similar model or skills to those industries.
So you know, we'll see what happens there. You got to get a little creative. I think just an outbound SDR effort probably isn't, you know,
enough.
It won't yield that many results, but we'll see.
Well, it's the probability of success. I think you have to play your cards in all these categories, and that's what a smart, you know, organization's doing as well. We have to kind of do that for ourselves.
Yep.
You know, you want to get your inbound engine revved up, even in a SaaS environment where you have SDRs. You want to get it to a point where you kind of have it come the market coming to you, right? So that's a stage where if you're not there yet, you're probably going pretty cold outbound. You're building your brand.
Yeah.
So if you're a consultant starting out, you might have to do some of that, but more targeted towards maybe your network and getting warm introductions. Because we hear time and time again from consultants on the show that a lot of their early clients are coming by way of that. And even to this day, it's word of mouth and recommendations. I know that's
definitely
almost 100% of my client work.
Yeah.
Right. So,
but that's, I am sort of planting seeds for growth beyond, because I know that what I want to accomplish is not going to,
you don't want to stay
come
solo,
only from my network.
It's the same thing. The founder outgrows their Rolodex at some point, they've taken advantage of all their intros with the board and whoever. So exactly. Now you actually have to get out there and shake some trees.
Yeah.
And always be prospecting, as they say. And it has different flavors. Always be networking. But the point is always be building pipeline so that you don't come out of a project or projects and then wonder how you're going to eat. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. I do face the prospect of doing too many things not well, which, by the way, like, is something that I think earlier in this podcast I was spouting about how you need to plan well and do things holistically and all that. so there you go. Do as I say, not as I do.
Well, I mean, we're right now we're a solopreneurs, so it's solo operators, and our motion is different than organizations that are 10, 20, 50 million in revenue and beyond. So, I face that same dilemma of like, am I cold calling enough? And like, well, at the end of the day, while I teach that, that's not necessarily my mode of acquiring business.
That's right. So,
well, this has been great. Tom, thank you. You've shared us some tremendous stories and given us another way of thinking about sales enablement more broadly than I think some of us might be thinking about it today, with just content creation and delivering just-in-time content and these things, right? I mean, there is important roles that it's playing, but I love the project management aspect of it and how you can bring all the disparate teams and projects together so that it actually gets adoption. And that's what we're trying to move the needle on. We're not just trying to invest this money into these programs and then not move the needle. And so I think that's definitely the one that learning, even at a smaller organization, if you can get someone who's hyper-focused on project management, you can start seeing things get executed a lot faster. So strategy all the way down to execution has been covered today.
Yeah.
Where do you want to send people to learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah. So my website is gomo-consulting.com. Come on by, check out the resources tab in particular for some content there. And then, search for Tom George at Gomo on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect.
You've been listening to the Sales Consultant Podcast. If you enjoyed the interview and would like to support the show, please be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and or on Spotify. Please also consider following our LinkedIn page. If you're an industry expert, or if you know an industry expert that should be on the show, message us on LinkedIn at the Sales Consultant Podcast.